with Mr. Thomas Polga. Kind of sounds like kind of a squeaky tape. Aim it towards you a little bit.
Let me tell you something, it's not the equipment that counts, but the people who use it.
No, and that's one of the things that I've come to find. I've had interviews and my tapes didn't even come out, but it didn't matter as long as my notes were good.
In my intelligence career, I never used tapes. I always relied on taking notes and my memory.
Well, I tape, but I also take notes at the same time.
Of course, even a generation ago, it would have been considered a terrible insult to walk into a meeting with a tape recorder.
I see. Well, my wife's been trying to get me to get one of those little pocket ones, but they cost like $90, $100, though. I just keep using this one anyway.
If you don't mind carrying it, the difference isn't worth it.
No, and the little ones with the little...
And furthermore, this uses the standard cassette, and the little one has to use the special...
That's what I was just going to say.
It's not good for anything else.
No, and also, they don't record very well. Mm-hmm. We went in and had a demonstration at the electronics store, and it just it didn't pick up the voice very well at all.
Right.
Anyway, maybe we could start by you telling me just a little bit about your background.
Well, tell me a little bit about yours first.
Okay, I'm an author. Maybe we could begin, Mr. Polgar, by you telling me a little bit about your background, please.
Well, I was born in Hungary. Came to the United States in 1938 as a student. Got a degree in business administration in New York. Worked for a couple of years as an accountant in New York. Then, after the United States entered the war, I got myself into the U.S. Army. Served in the Army with an infantry division. And then I was picked up by the Office of Strategic Services, which was the World War II predecessor of today's CIA.
Mm-hmm.
After the war, I continued to work as an intelligence officer in Berlin. And when CIA was established, I was hired as a civilian intelligence officer by the CIA, and I spent the next almost 35 years in CIA.
So you went in 47?
Well, that's when CIA was established.
Okay.
I went in with the first batch.
Okay.
I was one of the founding fathers. And I retired at the end of 1981, and since then I've been a management consultant, and I do quite a bit of writing for the Miami Herald, American Legion magazine, Orlando Sentinel, which is our local newspaper, and also for a German newspaper.
Is this a column?
Well, it's more like sort of feature-length articles when something comes up on which I feel like writing. For example, in next Sunday's Miami Herald, I will have a major article on the administration's misuse of the National Security Council staff.
I could talk to you about that for a while. I'm always interested to hear. When did you get assigned to the as chief of station in Saigon?
I arrived to take up my duties as chief of station in January of 1972.
And you replaced Ted Shackley?
I replaced Ted Shackley.
Okay.
Did you have an opportunity to talk to
I've written him a letter, but I didn't get a response. I think that after he might talk to me. He's kind of besieged these days, so...
Well, it's not so much that he's deceived off the record, I think, that he has got a serious health problem.
Oh, okay.
I understand that he has cancer of the prostate, but I cannot tell you that for a fact. And I think that is probably the reason why he may not have gotten an answer.
Well, that's pretty unfortunate. Mm-hmm. January 72. What were your... Had you been a chief of station in any other stations before? Mm-hmm. So you knew...
Before instance, yes.
Before instance, okay. Were your duties substantially different in Vietnam? Was it a different situation than usual?
Yes, it was very different from a usual station. First, because of the wartime environment. Secondly, because of the size of the station, which inevitably resulted in much more, shall we say, administrative and management problems than you would have in a normal CIA station. And thirdly, because of the very controversial nature by that time in 1972 of the entire American effort in Vietnam. Therefore, as a chief of station, you had to spend a lot more time worrying about your public relations, the press, congressional visitors, White House visitors, than in a routine CIA assignment where you would not encounter the press, not encounter the White House.
As a matter of policy, you
right.
keep a low profile.
Right.
So it was a much higher profile.
It was very different. Yes.
Okay. What about the nature of the programs that you were overseeing?
Well, by the time around I arrived in Vietnam, a transformation had taken place under the regime of Ted Shackley. And by the time I arrived, the CIA station in Vietnam was essentially a straight intelligence collecting station.
No more covert operations or paramilitary operations?
No paramilitary operations at all, and practically no covert operations.
Was your background in intelligence rather than covert operations?
My background was in intelligence collection throughout my CIA career. However, during my OSS days, I was in what you would call covert operations.
I understand that there's not, sometimes it's hard to distinguish between
A chief of station is supposed to be, let's say, at the my grade level, is supposed to be able to handle both.
Was so the thrust of the station is on intelligence collection?
Entirely.
What was the main apparatus for doing that? Was it the special branch?
No, the special branch was one of our liaison contacts. We had a number of liaison contacts. Naturally, we dealt across the board with all the agencies of the South Vietnamese government concerned with intelligence and security matters, and one of our tasks under the heading of intelligence was, of course, to improve the intelligence collection capabilities of the Vietnamese.
But apart from that, you had your own collection.
Apart from that, we had our own sources.
Okay. So did you have a deputy in charge of a liaison division?
Let's see how very organized. Yes, the way we were organized is we had an operations division and we had a reports and analysis division and an administrative division, and the chief of liaison operated as an element of the operations division.
That's operations, reports and analysis, and management?
well, administration support.
And liaison would be under operation.
Would come under operation.
What about the relationship with CORDS? When CORDS was disbanded and programs that had originally been CIA programs, for instance, Chu Hoy and some of those other programs.
No, by the time I arrived on the scene, all those activities were under CORDS or under the several successor organizations of CORDS in Vietnam, and they were basically under the control of the military.
Okay, I see. And is that MACV or is that the Defense Attaché?
MACV.
Okay.
MACV. And MACV had a deputy for civilian operations, and that was, in my days, Mr. Jacobson.
Right, okay. Incidentally, I've interviewed Colonel Jacobson also. He was pretty helpful to me and opened a lot of doors.
Well, he knows as much about Vietnam as anybody.
Upon arriving, did Mr. Shackley brief you and make you familiar, or was it, how did you become familiar with?
Well, actually, after I was appointed Chief of Station, which was in July of 1971, at this time I was in South America, I have arranged to take an orientation trip to the East Asia, and I visited Thailand, Laos, and Vietnam. And that was in October of 1971. And then I've had extensive briefings in Washington. So by the time I arrived in Vietnam, I was not totally ignorant of what was happening. And when I arrived, Shackley, whom I had known at that point, I guess, for 20 years or so, just made it very simple. He moved another desk into his office, and we just did. We were together, literally, all day. We went to the same meetings, we looked at the same cable traffic, we looked at the same reports. I stayed at his home. We had lunch together, we had dinner together. So during our 10-day or so overlap, which was a little bit less because I took time out in that period to visit many of the province detachments. But during those 10 days, you know, he tried to give me as much insight and as much benefit of his experience as was possible.
Okay. In January of 72, Phoenix was still in effect.
Yes, I think it was still in effect, but it had nothing to do with the CIA station.
Okay. When Phoenix was originally constructed, it was built on the CIA province and region structure, using the region and province
officers.
Well,
I do not know. That was before my time.
Okay. Did your briefing include any briefing on Phoenix? Were you told anything about Phoenix or that?
Well, I had heard about Phoenix by then, of course, because during my previous assignment, I said I was Chief of Station in Argentina.
Okay.
And it so happens that the head of the military advisor group in Argentina, Brigadier General Allen, had come directly from Vietnam, where he commanded a brigade. So I heard quite a bit about Phoenix from him.
What did you hear about it from him, can you say?
Well, Allen was a straight infantry soldier, and typical product of Fort Benning. In fact, he was from Georgia himself.
Excuse me? Okay.
I think we were talking about General Allen's views. And, you know, as an infantry soldier, he felt that the mission of the U.S. military should be the destruction of the other side's military. And he didn't like to see our military diverted to what are essentially police tasks.
Okay. That's a pretty common feeling among the military about Phoenix. They didn't like, they felt that it was...
This was not their job.
Imposed on them, right. And they didn't, it wasn't proper.
Right.
Okay. Do you think that Phoenix would be a proper role for CIA?
In general terms or specifically as applied in Vietnam?
Either. That it's interesting that you would think of it in both terms.
Well, I think that when you are dealing with subversion, an organized counter-subversion campaign would certainly be an appropriate thing for the defending governments to undertake. And if it is our policy to help that government to defend itself, then I don't see anything wrong with giving aid and support to their counter-subversion campaign.
Through CIA?
Probably through CIA, because I don't know how else you could do it.
Okay. 'Cause in,
I think that they tried it, for example, in Uruguay through aid.
Right.
I mean, that was quite a disaster, really.
Well, they also had public safety aid in Vietnam advising the national police.
They did.
And that was, of course, Mr. McCann, I believe, was probably...
That's correct. McCann was there and I was there.
And they took over a lot of the Phoenix.
Yes, and that is not right either, in my opinion, because American policemen are not trained in a counter-subversive role. I think American public safety was perfectly fine to assist local police agencies on teaching traffic control, teaching identification procedures, teaching police organization, criminal detection, etc. But the average American police official, I'm not talking about patrolmen on the street, I'm talking about the captain and assistant and superintendent and assistant commissioner and inspector levels, they themselves never had any experience with counter-subversion, because subversion in the United States is not a major problem to begin with. And when it appears, it's an FBI responsibility, not a local police responsibility.
Okay. Is that because of the political nature of it, do you think?
No, because essentially we have municipal police forces or state police forces, you know, whose jurisdiction is territorially very limited.
Okay.
And when you are dealing with a federal problem, inevitably the federal agency has to get involved.
Okay. Of course, the National Police in Vietnam eventually did absorb Phoenix responsibilities.
Well, the National Police in Vietnam, of course, was a very, very different thing from what we conceived to be the police force to be in the United States. And the National Police didn't absorb Phoenix, and it also absorbed the CIA's provincial reconnaissance units.
Okay.
At which point the program started to go downhill.
Okay. When was that absorption of true and Phoenix. That occurred during your tenure?
It occurred during my tenure, and I would put it somewhere in the late summer of 1972. Okay. When I arrived in Vietnam, I came under instructions to phase out PRU.
And how did you go about doing that?
Well, I negotiated it with the National Police and with the President's Assistant for National Security Affairs.
Choose,
yes. And I'm talking about General Quang.
Okay. That's Q-U-A-N-G?
Q-U-A-N-G.
Right, okay. He had at one time been commander of the PRU in the Delta.
No, he was commander of the Delta as a whole.
Okay. I understand that the National Police didn't want the PRU. Was that the case?
The National Police had no problem with PRU, but they felt that they had no money for it.
Was that in effect the problem?
Probably. By 1972, Vietnam was getting to be an increasingly poor country.
And USAID, of course, is diminishing.
USAID is diminishing. Mm-hmm. The 1972 offensive, of course, put a tremendous financial burden on the Republic of South Vietnam. They had an enormous refugee flow they had to take care of. I would say the cost of the 1972 offensive, mm-hmm, and then the oil embargo of 1973, which resulted in a skyrocketing of oil prices, along with the diminishing USAID, created tremendous financial pressures on South Vietnam.
Was there a PRU national advisor on the Vietnamese side, and did he have an American advisor?
No, as far as I know, there was no such thing.
Okay. But PRU was a national program, was it not?
PRU was a program of the CIA that was applicable to all of South Vietnam, but we didn't necessarily have PRU everywhere in South Vietnam.
Okay.
We had it in some places where the local environment suggested its desirability, and mm-hmm, we didn't have it in other places where there seemed to be no need for it.
I think in the public, Phoenix is often confused with PRU.
I don't think that the public has any idea that such a thing as PRU existed.
Okay. There's some sort of burgeoning awareness. Can you talk to that subject at all about PRU?
What aspect?
Okay, well, I know is that the province chiefs needed a reaction force which would be accountable to them, because they couldn't always rely on the military to provide support when they needed it.
No, the CIA created PRU. No. That's far
okay.
too ambitious a role for the PRU, because nothing like that.
Okay.
The PRU was a very, very modest counter-subversion force which had a dual mission. First, to spot and to identify members of the Viet Cong cadre or other communist sympathizers, with the objective of recruiting them as intelligence sources.
In effect, double agents. sending them back into the...
Not necessarily sending them back, but getting them to report.
Okay.
You get into things like double agent that opens up a whole new kettle of...
Okay.
A whole new bucket of worms.
Okay.
And because the way people throw around terms such as double agent and so forth is not necessarily correct in terms of the actual intelligence usage.
Okay.
But, so anyway, the crew had in the first instance the task of identifying potential sources on the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. And secondly, to conduct small-scale raids for the purpose of capturing prisoners or documents that would help us to gain a better understanding of what the enemy was up to.
Okay. Were they involved?
So, as far as I'm concerned, Peru was a logical extension of CIA's intelligence collection mission in South Vietnam.
Okay. Are there similar programs to Peru in other countries that CIA runs?
I do not know.
Okay.
I mean, certainly I can't imagine having a Peru type organization anywhere in Western Europe.
Okay. Okay. Well, what about in South America?
I do not know.
Okay.
We didn't have it in my days in Argentina, and we certainly had nothing like that in Mexico.
Is Peru involved in, is it political at all insofar as, is it used as a political tool to change people's attitudes?
Peru, no.
No. Okay, that's revolutionary development?
No, had no political role whatsoever.
Okay.
I mean, if you think of the Peru like the Philippine Scouts.
Okay. Which brings to mind...
They were an intelligence, let's say it was a unit that focused on collecting intelligence through occasionally violent means.
Okay. It's interesting that you talk about the Philippines because General Lansdale, of course, mm-hmm. is achieved renown and fame for his political teams in the Philippines, which had as their objective use of violence and propaganda in order to convert people to the government side. Yes. In the Philippines. That's well documented. That's part of his psychological warfare, psy war, political warfare doctrine. And the CIA, of course, had the same program in South Vietnam through revolutionary development. The revolutionary development teams would go into a village and help not only with programs, but they would also...
Long before my day.
Okay. This is what I was going to ask. Was RevDev, Revolutionary Development, still a program while you were there? Or had the government given up on that?
I don't know whether the government... No, the government hadn't given up on that, but it had nothing to do with CIA.
Okay. Is that, one of the CORDS program?
CORDS must have had some role in it, yes.
Okay. But you would separate Peru from those kind of political action programs?
Absolutely. Peru had no political role except in the very remote sense that to the extent that we were weakening the Viet Cong, the prospects of the government would improve.
Okay. But that's certainly not the objective, that's just a result.
Okay.
was there an American advisor for Prue Affairs? I've often heard that it was Tucker Gugelman.
Tucker Gugelman was long gone from Vietnam by the time I got there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, during my days, the CI officer in charge of the regions and of the provinces had the responsibility for maintaining contact with the local crew.
Okay.
I did not have on my staff in Saigon a man who had the crew task.
Okay, that's something I wanted to understand, is find out whether there was a national organization. It's just region and province. Okay.
Of course, as I mentioned to you before, by the time I arrived in Vietnam, I had instructions to divest myself of Prue.
Okay.
So,
is that from Langley or?
From Langley.
Okay.
So, and that instruction was a result of a gradual disengagement of CIA from Prue that had already taken place during the Shakti regime.
Okay.
So by the time I arrived, Prue was not a big deal.
And it was basically Ted Shackley who reversed the John Hart. John Hart had been carrying on the deeper involvement of the CIA in covert and paramilitary operations, and when Shackley arrives, then there's a shift back from that?
No, I don't think that we can put the onus on John Hart.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the CIA was deeply involved in the paramilitary effort in Vietnam, starting, I suppose, with Colby, and then continuing through the several chief of stations through Hart, mm-hmm. and even Lapham, right. And then during Shackley's day. And Shackley came in about 6 or 8 months after the Tet offensive. There was a gradual change, mm-hmm. of emphasis in the station.
Okay. I understand through the force of his personality, Ted Shackley had a lot to do with that change of emphasis.
Well, I don't think that any of the station chiefs in Vietnam were known for their weak personality.
Okay.
That's not why they were sent there.
Okay, very good. Right.
And, I think it reflected a change in consensus in Langley, okay. as to what should be the proper role of the CIA.
Did you agree with that consensus?
Yes, certainly. I have always felt that the principal role of the CIA should be the collection and analysis of intelligence, and that nation building and similar socially oriented projects really do not belong in our charter.
It seems to me, just as my own observation, that whenever the CIA gets involved in paramilitary, well, small paramilitary seems to be all right, but nation building, it trips up their own intelligence gathering operations and then inevitably leads to problems.
What is often happening in those circumstances that you start to believe your own propaganda.
Okay. F. Scott Fitzgerald said, be careful of what you pretend to be, someday you may wake up and be it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As I had occasion to point out in a recent Miami Herald article, that fooling ourselves does not necessarily fool the enemy.
Okay. What about the, moving to a different subject, Unless there's something else you wanted to say about Prue, or is there, would there be somebody that you could, you know, you would think would be more knowledgeable?
No, unfortunately, the officer who knew most about Prue was a by the name of Phil Potter, had died a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And Ron Landreth, another one who would have known about it, also died a couple of years ago. So
Ron
Landreth, but he's dead.
Yeah. Well, Would anybody from the were you in touch with anybody from the any of the police advisors other than Michael McCann, who might have followed it in its closing days?
No. Okay. Well, I tell you the truth, I was pretty busy with my own responsibilities in Vietnam. I didn't have much time to develop into the responsibilities of others.
Okay. Well, then let's move on to the special branch, which I assume remained one of your responsibilities.
Oh yes. Oh,
okay.
Yes. Special branch was one of the important elements of our liaison with the South Vietnamese authorities.
Okay. Before I get into the special branch itself, the special branch ran what was called the PIC program, the Province Interrogation
Centers,
which I understand were advised by, had CIA advisors at the PICs, and the CIA also always advised the special branch, but particularly the PICs. Was that a program that you also phased out, or did that remain in place under South Vietnamese control?
No. The province interrogation centers were entirely under South Vietnamese control, and we didn't have officers who were assigned to the PICs. We had officers in the provinces whose duties included, among other things, liaison with the South Vietnamese to see if the PICs have turned up information or personalities of value.
Yeah.
And they tried to ensure, working with their local counterparts, that when a person of unusual knowledge appeared in the PICs, that he would be sent to Saigon for the National Interrogation Center.
Would that be the province officer who report this to the region officer, who would then say, well, let's send this guy on to Saigon, basically?
Yes, he would talk with his regional chief, certainly, but the decision to send somebody to Saigon was a Vietnamese decision.
I see. Okay.
Now, obviously, the Vietnamese would, in most cases, be very receptive to suggestions.
And would the first impulse be to try and get this person to come over to the GVN side and then go back as an agent himself, is that kind of a, you have to, or would he just be debriefed and then jailed?
Ideally, and I'm speaking now in entirely general terms, when you get somebody who comes over from the other side, your first thought must be, can I send him back?
Okay.
Because obviously a chicken that lays eggs is of more value than the egg.
Okay. If conditions prohibited that, then just debriefed and then incarcerated or whatever?
If conditions prevented that, then you took a look at the guy to find out what he knows. And what he knows is not always immediately obvious.
Okay. So that might be an extended period of...
A man may know many things that he himself doesn't even realize that he knows.
Okay. Is the National Interrogation Center part of the special branch. Is that the special branch?
The national interrogation was under the jurisdiction of the Vietnamese Central Intelligence Office.
Did Special Branch have its own interrogation facility?
I would imagine so, because they certainly had detention facilities in the National Police Headquarters, but Special Branch was exactly what the name implies. It was a specialized counterinsurgency, counter-subversion unit of the National Police.
Okay.
It wasn't a terribly big organization, and